And now, the starting lineup for your
Gangsters. What's up, guys?
Are you a slacker?
MVP.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
God bless the internet.
What the hell's going on out here?
Hello and welcome to Flicking and Screaming. I am Jed Sprague here with my co-hosts, Evan Fagundes.
Hey.
And JT Chipman.
Hey, fellas.
This week we are talking about Todd Haynes' newest film, May, December, generating a little bit of awards buzz here as we end off the year. Before we get into that, gentlemen, how are we doing? How are you guys?
I'm doing very well. Busy. I just got finished doxing the guy who said Asteroid City was one of the worst movies of the year on Variety. I don't know if that made its way across your feeds, but it did mine, and his little blurb on it was just, I just had to get his home address out there. It only felt right. So now I got that off my chest. How are you, Evan?
I'm doing pretty well. I got to see Sorkin dialogue delivered live on Friday at To Kill a Mockingbird, a showing of To Kill a Mockingbird in San Francisco. So I feel like I'm still kind of like riding that high, or at least like riding that, you know, crossing of streams of a whole bunch of real life and Flicking and Screaming type sensibilities. But I'm doing pretty well. Yeah, it's nice and rainy, so I'm happy to be inside talking to you guys. How are you doing, Jed?
Evan, don't bury the lead. You also have purchased tickets to see all three extended editions of Lord of the Rings in the theaters at Alamo Drafthouse.
I did. Yes. Speaking of, you know, real life meeting the pod, like that was very much just something that happened in like 4 minutes on Saturday night.
If anyone loved me, they would find a way to make that happen in Reno at like the Cinemark 17 or whatever it's called. I'm doing well. I'm exhausted. End of the year with work is always, you know, crazy trying to get things in before the holidays, and been a lot hosting Christmas this year. So we're, you know, getting ready, spending lots of money and food and alcoholic beverages, and, you know, but also we wrapped some presents last night, and my daughter walked down the stairs this morning and screamed, Santa was here. And so it's all worth it. We had to explain, no, these are presents for mom and dad. Santa's coming down the chimney. But like, we're fishy in full swing, you know, 7 days out. The fervor is palpable. She is like literally having like hyperventilating, you know, once a day about the prospect of Christmas. So I would say things are going well. But it was nice to, you know, kind of take a bath in these cooler, I would say more lukewarm waters of Savannah, Georgia in May, December. It was, it was an experience. I'm interested to know, right off the top, Julianne Moore or Natalie Portman in this movie? Who did it for you?
Wow. Give me no chance to breathe here. My nope. God. I mean, it's almost a little bit unfair because Natalie Portman is playing a not great actor. She has to give a bit of a bad performance for a bad actor, but she's really good at giving this bad performance. So you have to really dig into the layers there to break down exactly how good she's doing it. And I think it's kind of going over some people's heads. I think the focus is really on Julianne Moore and on Mr. Melton for obvious reasons, because those are amazing performances / breakthrough performances. But for me, I think that Natalie Portman actually might stand the test of time a little bit more, because I think what she's doing is actually a little bit more impressive and difficult to pull off. I think that the not only like the personal parts of her being an actor and kind of making fun of and poking fun at a lot of the actor stereotypes, tearing down ideas of method acting and research while also doing them in, you know, a ridiculous way, not an accurate way at all. It's poking fun at something that doesn't really exist. And I think that performance is pretty spectacular. So there's my answer, since you put me on the spot.
That's a fantastic answer. I agree. Natalie Portman, out of everyone, Natalie Portman is who I walked away from this movie both times, really thinking about a lot. I think it's like an exceptional performance, like one of the best of the year, and completely vulnerable. I think, especially when you watch, if you guys end up having a chance to watch this movie a second time, it really is illuminating how ridiculous the first half of the movie is, especially from her character's perspective, but specifically her performance with the conclusion of this movie. And obviously we're going to get into spoilers here, but the final scene of this movie is basically just lambasting everything that she'd done, especially in the first like 50 minutes of this movie. So to see her like kind of wandering around, like so earnestly taking notes and stuff on like a family barbecue and things like that. I just think she sells it so well, and you really do believe it, and I feel like she is the enigma that the movie wants her to be, and I don't think that's necessarily an easy thing to pull off. However, Julianne Moore's performance is incredibly fun, which sounds almost bizarre to say for the person that she's
I was going to say, but can you clarify what's fun about her?
I just mean fun in that she's doing a lisp. She's doing a lot of like ups and downs, right? She gets to do like the Julianne Moore sobbing. Like there's a lot more of that, like more obvious acting, which is funny because she's the one who's supposed to not be playing the professional actor, but her character is kind of constantly acting for everyone that she shares scenes with. And I put that in quotes because it's who she's living her life with, but she's kind of constantly performing.
The Julianne Moore sob is an important part of the last 30 years of movie making.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys think this movie was funny?
This is a question that's been raging. Incredibly. Does this deserve to be in comedy nominations at the award shows?
Let's just get this out of the way.
I don't know about that.
Let's just get this out of the way. The first 25 minutes, there are some incredibly funny lines.
It is hysterical.
Right? I think everyone can agree on that. Right?
Yeah. No doubt. And I think it's
after that where it becomes a question, because I think that's, like you were talking about, Chip, the thing that's raging across the internet right now is like it got nominated in musical comedy. And it's like, whoa, okay, what movie were you watching? Because I'll come out and say from the beginning, there's a lot I really loved about this movie. I also found myself like quite disturbed, and I'm really like struggling to wrap my arms around it as like an entire piece of art. Like I was kind of blown away, I think, by especially the three, I would say just like the three lead performances. I think we're all just like insanely good. And I can't remember like a stronger, like, you know, top of the line, you know, just all the performances that mattered being as good as they needed to be. But also like, I think the subtext I really enjoy, but the actual text of this movie I found incredibly disturbing and like really hard to like to wrangle with. And like then like also like viewing it through the lens of a comedy makes that almost twice as hard, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's certainly not pleasant when you really look at the facts. I'm reminded of a lot of, especially in the lead up to the final season, is Succession a comedy or tragedy? Was thrown around quite a bit. I would argue the ending of that show, those last 5 minutes, are pure tragedy. There's nothing funny about it. The ending of May December is almost parodying the tragedy because they are reenacting the canon event that sparks this tragedy on a movie set, but it's so ridiculous and it's almost beyond the pale that Natalie Portman is doing this terrible list imitating Julianne Moore, that they have this, you know, ridiculous, not 13-year-old playing a 13-year-old with a real snake in the final line of the movie. It's getting real, and it's not getting real at all. It's a Lifetime soap opera, true crime knockoff of the real story. So
Chip, I don't think he's sexy enough.
You don't think? God, that line killed. That line killed. I say killed. I watched it by myself. It killed in to the voices in my head. It killed.
It killed for me too. Yeah, I think you make a good point, Chip. Evan, anything else?
I would say I wouldn't necessarily categorize it as a comedy, but I think I'd argue well beyond the first 25 minutes, almost every scene that there was a line that nearly made me laugh out loud. And part of it, I think, is because it is loosely based on real life people. and events that are familiar to us, at least through like gossip columns, you know, the news, whatever. You kind of know who these people are and what they've done basically immediately. So you're not spending the movie trying to figure out, like, is this a good person? Is it, like, especially around Julianne Moore's character, right? Like, I found her extremely funny, partly because, like, I'm laughing at her absurdity. And in that way, this movie reminded me a lot of, like, some Coen Brothers movies and how it can often feel like you're laughing at characters in the movie versus laughing with them. And I know that's a turnoff for some people with Coen Brothers movies, but it felt similarly in this movie, where it's like, I am not feeling bad about finding these situations funny because I'm laughing at what a ridiculous person, specifically the two leading ladies are, the ridiculous people in this movie.
That's
kind of, I wouldn't call it a comedy.
That Coen's energy is kind of, that's a pretty good shout. Like, I could see kind of the comps of, like, the more serious parts of Hail Caesar is basically, like, the tone of this entire movie. And I think the difference is, like, whereas I feel like with the Coens, the end sort of always devolves into, like, this was a comedy the whole time. This almost goes the opposite direction, and I think that's what I'm struggling with so much. There's a lot to talk about.
A serious man, I think, is a good... Yeah. Is an interesting comp for this. Like, the tornado coming down the road has an eerie similarity to, like, all of this building towards that horrible looking exploitative movie that they're making. You know, like, there's a similar sort of, like, wow, it was all leading us here, you know, like, yeah. Just to watch her seduce a 12-year-old.
I think the Coens also just don't. They have a lot of contempt for their leading characters sometimes. And I don't think that Todd Haynes thinks too highly of either Natalie Portman or Julianne Moore's characters in this film. Granted, one of them is perhaps more evil in their actions that incite everything. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, when Natalie Portman sleeps with Joe, like with Charles Melton, she's straight up using him and makes no bones about it and still really doesn't treat him like an adult. No one treats him like an adult in this movie or, you know, treats him in the way that he needs to be treated. And that's, I mean, Charles Melton is the performance that really stands out. And I know that's a bit obvious because of what all the critics are saying and what the awards circuits are saying right now. But, I mean, he's just unbelievable. You talk about the tornado. When he gets in the room with Julianne Moore at the end, that's the tornado to me.
Yeah. Yeah. When he's basically like weeping, being like, why does it matter? Like, what brought it up? You know, if we are as in love as we say we are, shouldn't we be able to talk about these things? That, I agree, Chip. I think it's fair. We talked a lot about Portman and Julianne Moore, and I think rightly so, right there on the poster. And, you know, that's kind of the juxtaposition of the whole movie. But many ways, Melton is like, who grounds this movie. And I think his performance is also what makes it like really hard, because I think if he was a little bit more like slapsticky, right, then you can write this movie off as like kind of more full parody. But like, there's like some raw emotion in what he's giving and what he's delivering, and that is like, that's what I found like incredibly disturbing, like hard to like to reckon with, like, decisions you made when you were 13 years old, right? And like, and in like, especially like lustful decisions that you made at 13, right? Like, when we were all basically at our most hormonal and stupid, essentially.
Yeah. And he doesn't engage in any of the campy jokes that I think Portman and Moore bounce around. Like, he might have like a like a funny line about like his bug or something, like the bugs in the living room or something like that, right? But he's not doing the melodrama, ridiculous overacting that Moore, like, he is a completely broken person. And he's very sincere all the way through those breakdowns that he has, not only with Portman after she sleeps with him, but with Moore when he confronts her for the first time and is like, what really happened? Why am I like this? Why do I hurt? Why are you not even talking about me to me about my hurt, right? It's his level of remove from their ridiculousness, his innocence that's so totally broken, but he's still trying to like the way he preserves the butterflies to me, like his passion for protecting these creatures, for wanting them to go through their proper life cycle, to be able to hatch, to be born, to be reborn. I mean, it's there's so much like metaphor there, but his quote where he's like, keep your eyes open, protect them so they have a chance to grow. And it's like, it's hitting the nail on the head way too obviously, perhaps, but because it's from such a sincere character and not from one of the melodramatic characters, you feel it that much more.
And like, that's how people are, you know, like if you've ever, you know, read about psychology or anything like that, like people are quite obvious in real life about what they're making up for, what, you know, how they're dealing with their traumas. And I think it's like borderline genius writing his character specifically, because just his existence is the constant reminder of like the horror that we're witnessing, which I think is so effective. That's why the two leading ladies are able to go so big in their performances, and it's able to get ridiculous at times, because the second you snap back to him just sitting on the couch with a beer, you're like, oh my God, like this is a 12-year-old that is now just a 12-year-old with a 21-year-old and two 18-year-old kids. You know, like that is horrifying and disgusting and cruel. And just him being in the movie is an embodiment of that. And then he, with his performance, does an amazing job of, like, I saw somebody on Twitter say he somehow moved and acted like a 13-year-old the entire movie. And like, I couldn't read anything more accurate than that. Just the way he would like stand in a doorway. He was a very big man too, but yeah, he seemed like he slunk around like a sneaky kid who was like always in trouble.
Even the way he's dressed, everything from his haircut, like they do such a good job of like kind of putting him in that state of arrested development of like, that is just like a 13-year-old man child. You know, and like every and time his kids call him dad, you're like, what the, like, it just doesn't, it like looks weird. Like when he first comes on screen, like before it's kind of aware of what happens, like you almost think that that's like her oldest son, you know? Yeah,
that's two. That's her first lines to him in the movie. When he grabs a beer out of the fridge, she said, that's two. I mean, that's like, talk about good, right? Like, that's like the whole movie.
And she's so dismissive. Exactly. She's so dismissive of his butterflies, calling them his bugs, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
But who's in control here? Who is in charge?
It's crazy.
All right.
Absolutely crazy. And then she's like, Yeah. No, we'll get to
Todd Haynes.
There we go. Todd Haynes. The movie.
Sorry,
is
Todd
Haynes.
My bad. I missed an A.
Yeah.
Amazing how that can
happen. No, it's all good. Chip, what is your relationship to Todd Haynes?
I feel this is embarrassing because like 2 weeks in a row, it's been like, hey, this is the first movie I watched by this director. It's our first movie I watched by this director.
Same here.
And I loved it.
Nice. So I've seen his last movie, Dark Waters, with Mark Ruffalo. I very much liked that movie when it came out a few years ago. And then the only other one that I'd seen of his, actually recently, about halfway through this year, about 6 months ago, I saw Carol for the first time with Emily and loved it. Like, seriously, really, really loved it. And it's going to kind of color how I think about this movie. But that's also like a very tension-filled movie that doesn't have a ton of like satisfying conclusions that it reaches, but is like superbly acted by Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, and it's just like an outstanding movie. So I my relationship to him is wanting to see more of his work, because everything that I've seen so far has been like nearly A plus level.
So I missed Dark Waters specifically, and I think when Dark Waters came out, I was kind of like, full confession, I used to not respect Mark Ruffalo as an actor, and that's something I've recanted. That's something that I have turned my back on, and I repented for my sins, said my Hail Marys, and now I'm like, oh, Mark Ruffalo is investigating corrupt energy companies. Why haven't I watched this movie? So that's really high on my watch list right now.
What's the one with Matt Damon in the goatee that's also about water pollution?
And he's not Stillwater. Stillwater, he has a goatee, but that's not the one you're talking about.
Maybe it is.
That's when he's in Paris, right? Looking for his daughter,
Yeah.
Still, okay, what's the one? Is maybe, am I getting confused with something else?
Stillwater is the one where he's a Southern boy whose daughter's gone missing in France, and he's like, I got to put on my flannel and go get her back.
Yeah, you know what? It's, I'm confusing that with, I think it might be a Wahlberg, like when he's like works on an oil rig, you know, where it blows up. Like, but that's what I'm saying.
Deep
is like
Deepwater Horizon.
Yes. So like that Deepwater Horizon and Darkwater, and for some reason, the, like those all, like when I think like Todd Haynes is like a name that I've been aware of, but when I go back and look at his filmography, I'm like, oh, what? Like the only one I really like know that I'm like, ah, that's one I should have gotten to at this point is Far From Heaven, you know? Like there's not really many that I feel like I've been like told I've missed. And it's an odd relationship to have with the director. And frankly, and I'm just going to be like completely honest, and this is, I'm going to be vulnerable on this podcast. So I hope you'll respect that. Like I'm like scrolling down through and like, it's like, not like a lot of the titles are jumping out at me. It's like, oh my God, got to see that, you know, got to watch that. Like, I think after seeing this based on the, like just purely the quality of the movie, I'm like, yeah, I have to see that. But before sitting down to watch this and like reviewing his filmography, I'm like, okay, I guess like it wasn't like I have to go back and see, you know, watch Carol, right? It didn't jump out at me.
That honestly is fair. And that's probably why I, for the same reasons, haven't like done the full watch through, because I've heard amazing things about Safe and stuff as well, reading a little bit more about him this year. Carol is the one, guys, like Carol could be like one of the movies of the pod, I feel like. I'll just put it out there.
I just looked
at it. Just to set expectations high.
Rooney Mara, Cate Blanchett, 1950s.
Yeah. Kyle Chandler.
It looks like it has an insane cast.
It is sweet. And it's like set around Christmas. So there's like a weird like melancholy around the holidays. Like it is a really exceptional movie.
I just have to say before we stray too far from this, your little Deepwater, Darkwater Horizon, Stillwater is just the ultimate like TBS on a Sunday dad movie trilogy marathon.
It's like the Bermuda, Triangle of dad movies.
It honestly is.
And by the way,
it's like
all
types of dads too.
Yeah, dad movies.
Because like Darkwaters is about an attorney. I don't know if you guys know, like it's about an attorney who's like representing small farms to sue, you know, big chemical company.
No, it's 100%. And it's like kind of hits the dad actor trifecta too. Like, you know, it's like dad's in the know, you know, like Evan, your dad is like the dark water. And then there's like dads with AR-15s, and that's Stillwater. And then there's like blue collar dads like that, like Mark Wahlberg.
Exactly.
And that's Deepwater Horizon. Like
they're all
like,
fighting country might, and
that's
family.
America, baby. That's America right there. That trifecta is America. I'm not going to say like, well, I don't want to go down the road of like, what are his hallmarks? Because I guess we're not really equipped to handle that question, given our like lack of experience, which is something that I find kind of fun and exciting. For this here podcast. But what I will say is like, there is this sense that I got watching this movie that it is a person that's made films with this kind of tone before, you know, like this sense of like coldness, this sense of you were talking about, you know, Wes Anderson earlier. So like the, you know, the dollhouse aspect of like everything, you know, being real, but fictional. I don't know. That's what I felt like watching this is it felt like playtime with Todd Haynes and these wonderful actors.
You know what's so interesting about you saying, because that has unlocked something for me. I do agree with what you're saying there, but it's funny because like based off the three movies that I've seen, but specifically talking about this one, he is so comfortable living in the like ambiguousness of being human. And I think that that's very interesting. Like he is very uninterested in saying like, this is a bad person, this is a good person, or at least he's uninterested in his movie being about punishing a bad person or, you know, ending with a sign that says good side, bad side. And that's not to say that this movie doesn't indict Julianne Moore's character, like it obviously does. And that's very obvious. But I think the movie lets that be the case just by showing you who Charles Melton's character is and what this has done to him and what this has done to their kids. You know, like, that to me is very interesting, and it almost feels so perfectly human, even though it feels very heightened in the moment when you're watching scene to scene.
Yeah, I think we talked about Alexander Payne, like, really understanding the human experience last week, right? And in many ways, this is kind of like the opposite of that, where it's like Alexander Payne understands, like, the plight of being human and, like, the emotion that it goes through. And Todd Haynes is seemingly, at least, and again, this is, like, based on this movie, to me, is seemingly saying, like, yeah, there are good people, there are bad people, there are good parts of bad people and bad parts of good people. Like, it is not up for me to decide, like, what is good and what is bad and who is a bad person. And I think it's a, like, really one of the more fascinating, like, scenes. I think he does a really good job of setting things up in this movie. Like, that's what I was, like, really blown away with. Like, I think about the scene with Natalie Portman at the high school, you know, and talking about, like, oh, have you done sex? Have you done sex scenes before? And then talking about, oh, you know, sometimes you get lost in, like, the, you know, like, you get lost in it. And it's like, am I faking, you know, am I faking being into it, or am I faking not being into it? And, like, that whole thing, you know, telegraphing later the sex scene with Joe. But also the question that gets asked of, like, why, you know, do you like playing bad people? Right. And it's like, oh, of course. Right. Because look at all these great things. Like, look at all these, all the, like, accolades people have won from, like, playing bad people. So in that, is he saying, like, the bad person, is it actually Gracie, or is it actually, you know, Elizabeth, who is using a quote unquote bad person's life story, like, to, like, try to gain something from it, right? Is she using it to exploit that, to get something out of it, right? Who is actually the bad person in that instance, right?
Yeah.
And I think, like, that's a fascinating, like, thing, is it's like, the movie doesn't present any answers, but fuck, it presents a lot of questions. And I think, like, that's the thing that, since I've watched it, I've just thought a lot about, like, it feels like it's got a lot to say without really putting a firm stance. And I think in a year where it feels like a lot of movies that we've watched and celebrated have actually come out with, like, really firm stances, it was kind of a refreshing change of pace, almost, for the tone of the movie to just ask questions without trying to solve it.
Sure. I think so. One other thing about that school scene is when she's talking about portraying bad people, she makes indirect eye contact with Gracie and Joe's daughter, who is there's so much unspoken that happens with those kids. Those kids never come out and say, like, this is wrong. Why am I, like, these kids have to reckon with the fact that they came from something, like, immoral, something just like basically evil, birthed them.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, that's just something that's impossible for them to live with, and clearly has fucked him up in one way or another. She, like, fat shames her daughter, Gracie does at one point. So, which does, that's not because she's, like, she's abusive for other reasons, but she's also just, like, kind of a crappy mom. And it's like,
that's it. Yes.
You know, it's hard to watch, and you feel so terrible for these kids that they never get the release point that Joe gets, where he actually gets to break down and say, why is this happening? What's wrong with me? They still haven't processed that yet. That's still internalized for them, and they've still got to go through stuff to get it out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's such a great point, because that's, like, I think that is sort of the movie taking a little bit of a side, because everyone around them is basically like, hey, something weird happened a long time ago, but it's all good. It's all good now. It's normal. Like,
dude, the entire town, just this little island, just ignores it all, and they just they're buddy buddies with them, and they grill and eat hot dogs with them.
Exactly. And what they would have you believe is, like, Gracie is delusional about what happened, you know, 24 years ago. However, outside of that transgression, that you know, lapse in her morality or whatever, everything else, she's lived life like a normal person, and whatever. Like, people get divorced, people have, you know, two families, like, whatever. People do that. And those little scenes just, like, show that it goes so far beyond that. And, like, she is like she does have a like just this super super strict like abusive streak in her that like continues to rear its head just constantly, and like it, and she manipulates people around her forever. So it's like, not only have these kids grown up in this obviously fucked environment where they know that they're like a product of this not only terrible situation but also just, you know, widely known situation, but they're still facing the consequences of that because of like who Gracie is.
Yeah, I God, yeah, it's so interesting too. And like I think it's cool that the movie doesn't really have like that like villain break where it like reveals her abusiveness and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, like look at this purely like look at evil incarnate, right? Like the calculated abuser. It is just like part of who she is, which I think is, again, like you were talking about, Evan, like so much more often, like that is what real life is, right? It's like the calculated abuser is not revealed. It is a person with like with just like very clear patterns of behavior that like slip in and out of like seeming like a villain and like a normal person. And I think that's what's so fascinating about this movie. Mm-hmm.
And like what the movie is getting at too is like, unfortunately, the way our society is set up and just the way people act in a civil society, in the civil society that we have like been born into, is that it is the job of the abuse victims to expose the abuser and to be the final word on it. So while everyone can see this, she has manipulated the people around her so successfully that everyone else just kind of goes along with it because they're like, her kids don't really seem to like openly hate her. Her husband still like hugs her at barbecues and has a good time with her. Like, who am I to be the one to go in there and start riling up a bunch of trouble for something that happened 25 years ago? So I think it just like shows what a constantly perpetuating cycle it is that she's basically like, as long as I can keep this little thing intact, then we're almost immune to everything else. And that's why it's like, that's why she feels like she has to control somebody like Elizabeth, who's coming in and is going to be telling their story. Like, she's like, if I can tightly control this, this can become another part of our little circle that like insulates me from any real criticism.
There is a moment.
Very secure.
I'm very secure.
You should put that in the movie.
There's a moment where they're sitting at the table, the three of them, and she and Natalie Portman says like, and in sixth grade, and simultaneously they correct her and say seventh. In a way that has obviously been rehearsed. They've done that before. And it's a little bit funny at first. You're like, aha, they, you know, they spoke it together. And like, no, it's actually a lot more sinister when you look under the table, because they've clearly rehearsed their story. They're trying to get on the same page. And also it's seventh grade. And she was 35 or whatever.
36. Yeah.
Yeah.
Evan, how did this read? Like, Chip mentioned something there that I thought was interesting. Chip, you've only watched it once, correct? How did it watch the second time, like versus the first time? Because I can imagine it's a much different experience.
Much different. Like, so utterly tragic. It's crazy. Like, the first time was horrifying, but the second time, you really understand, because you understand who everyone is. You only meet a few people really throughout this movie. Because you know who they are and you're not spending the scenes that you get like with, say, her attorney and different people and her like her Georgie, you know, her first son and stuff, like you're not figuring out who they are in the midst of meeting them within the movie. You just kind of realize that basically everyone who this lady has touched in her life is just completely just like fucked beyond repair. And it's like really, really horrifying to see. And it's not to say that like they don't have a chance to, you know, still live a fulfilling life and like get out of these cycles that they're in. But everyone who comes into this movie has basically been so negatively affected. And then it's almost doubly horrifying because Natalie Portman as Elizabeth just is not taking the correct messages at all from any of this. Like, she's just not empathizing with anyone who she meets around her. And I don't know. That would be the word that I'd say from the second time. It's just like, it's almost like more of a pure terror. And like, especially Charles Melton's character, you're just like, oh my God.
Natalie Portman's like an amoral character in this movie. She thinks that she's so far.
Correct.
The reality is that Charles Melton is the one who is removed from everything. He is the innocent one who's been shattered. And Portman thinks that she's like so above it all somehow, and that her being an actress, it's just a story, you know, everyone's complicated. It's I'm apolitical. I'm amoral. Mm-hmm. I'm completely neutral in this. And yet she's like still infiltrating and still like trifling, basically. Like she fucks Charles Melton up even more than he already was fucked up. And she thinks she's just got incredible main character syndrome, I think is kind of the best way to describe it.
Huge narcissist, right?
Incredible narcissism.
That's what in she's...
Dude, the way that she like says like
most,
she's like, oh, the crew, if I go long here and we got to slash the budget, we'll just give the crew mugs instead of hoodies. And it's like, you don't even think the crew are people. Like, that's a very funny line, but it's also very dark.
And it's how she's so easily able to assimilate Gracie. Cause like, that's what we haven't started talking about too. Some of the comedy of the movie is like in that scene, Jed, that you're describing, where she's in the high school drama class and the guy, you know, makes a comment and she goes, precisely. Like, she even does like the little lisp a little bit. And like, there are multiple times throughout this movie where she basically, before she even does the huge monologue as Gracie, she's like modeling Gracie's behavior. And I feel like it's very easy for her to do that because like they connect with this like intense narcissism where they're like, it is only about me. And like, everyone is being affected by me, but like, it's because I'm living my story.
What are some of your guys' favorite moments from the film? Like, just scenes, a couple of quick ones.
Charles Melton. So maybe I should go. Joe sitting with his son, Charlie, on the roof smoking weed for the first time.
Incredible.
Like, a character, first of all, it's like such a devastating moment, and again, so funny, like such good writing that this hugely devastating moment centers around a dad never having smoked weed and sort of being called on it by his son. But it's so indicative of the whole thing, like how he was never allowed to be 17 and get high with no regard for, you know, responsibilities or whatever outside of like maybe a little homework. And being able to do that with his son, and like his first, how funny it is when he turns and looks out at the ocean and he's like, cool. Like, that's like such a great response, like your first time getting high. And then like the breakdown into like him trying to figure out is opening up to his son, you know, like creating a trauma for him that he'll never recover from, or healthy because they need to open up more with each other. Like, it's such a complicated moment.
For me, the Natalie Portman monologue when she's reading the letter, because again, I do think that gets close to taking sides, but
it's an Oscar moment. It's an Oscar clip moment. It's like you're watching that and you're just like, oh my God. Like,
yes. And it's great because not only does it kind of indict Julianne Moore, but it's indicting Portman because she's just happy to deliver this monologue and she wants to be able to feel it. She literally sleeps with Joe so that she can feel this monologue even more. And not only that, but the content of that of that letter that she wrote to Joe it's clearly written by someone who is mature, someone who is knowledgeable, who literally says, make sure you don't show this letter to anyone because you know what will happen to me. Clearly trying to manipulate. And she says, oh, you were in control. No, it's clear who is in control, because this is a very well-worded, well-written, and very toxic and manipulative love letter to a 13-year-old, especially when you contrast it with the letter that he wrote to her when he was like, peace is a Coca-Cola and peace is hanging out with you in the summertime. And it's like, oh, this is an underdeveloped mind that this woman just completely warped and destroyed. But that scene is what really has stood out to me over the last few days thinking about the movie.
Great choice.
It's hard not to think of the scene with Joe and Gracie in the bedroom, like after he comes back from you know, dropping Elizabeth. And I mean, that to me just feels like kind of the pinnacle of the movie. Many ways. I really loved the diner scene with Elizabeth and Gracie's ex-husband. I thought it was great. Like, that was the first, you know.
His mannerisms are so good in that scene where it's just like, what are you going to do? Like, what makes a 36-year-old woman, like, have an affair with a 13-year-old?
Yeah, I love that he was kind of almost like, I could get it, maybe. Like, he's like, I was confused at first. I was like, oh, I thought we were in a happy marriage. And then it was just like, wait, whoa. It's kind of like the difference between, like, what have I done wrong? And, oh, I just married a sociopath. Like, that's the, you know.
It's all, again, it's all about the unspoken things. It's so much of the movie's reading between the lines.
His, like, recounting of the day, too, which just, like, the police show up my door and they're asking me about, you know, like, relationships with a minor. He's like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That scene is great.
Can we just, like, say, I think it was a brilliant stroke of genius when writing this movie that they didn't go the classic, like, teacher route. They worked together at a pet shop. Like, that is absolutely insane. Like, what does that even, like, the psychology behind, like, what does that even say about, like, her character, you know, as, like, a 36-year-old mother, and obviously, like, everybody has to work different jobs, but, like, that, like, working at, like, a pet shop and then having a, you know, like, her, basically the only other employee was a 13-year-old intern or, you know, hourly employee. Like,
how does a 13-year-old employee also, how does that happen? It's again, there's another failing that occurred somewhere along the line.
It's just a lot of really small.
It shows how insidious it might have been, too. You know, or, like, not, it was very insidious, but, like, it could have gone beyond just what the way she describes it, which is just like she had a complete moral failing because of this, like, intense connection, right? Like, that's her whole thing. And that's people who are pedophiles will say stuff like that, but they're just like, this unbroken bond, you know, like, I didn't ask for this. I didn't ask for the, like, whatever excuses. But that kind of takes away from that when it's like, oh, she said she wanted to bring somebody on and then chose specifically to, like, hire him as, like, you know, her help around the store. And she knew who he was. She knew he was, I mean, there's definitely a racial issue in that, you know, her saying, like, he's the only Korean family, and him saying half, you know, like, there is definitely that tension in there too. So it's like, you could almost think that she planned it from the second that she, like, did an interview at a pet store with a 12-year-old. Like, that's really, really nasty.
Can I just say that, like, the scene where the final scene we see of Gracie in the movie is her going hunting. It is the first scene in the movie where she that's right before the graduation. You're right.
Yeah, almost. But before. Yeah.
I mean, it's all there in the text. Like,
yes. Yeah. That's, she doesn't
Gracie's
speak
always
a word.
Loved to hunt.
She's always loved to hunt. She is stone-faced that entire time.
Mm-hmm.
She's on the warpath looking for her target, finds it, kill shot. Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's all it is, man.
Yeah. That is all it is. That is a great scene. And that's, like, one of those scenes too that, like, who would ever think to put that in there, but it's so effective. Can I throw out one more? The first time that Elizabeth meets Georgie, Gracie's older son.
Yeah.
He's singing for the band. First of all, another very funny thing, scene with the lawyer. And first, the lawyer's, like, just so, I mean, of course, like, everyone hates lawyers. Like, that's funny in movies. But the son coming over and, like, recounting that story of it happening right before his birthday. So they forgot to cancel his birthday and how he had one guy come over and they just sat there all night. Like, it's horrible. Like, it's so devastating when you're faced with these things. And I think the movie is very effective at, like, every 25 minutes putting in a scene like that where you're like, oh, that's the reality of this situation beyond, like, us seeing it through Elizabeth's eyes, which is just, like, this juicy character who's so ambiguous and, you know, her motivation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ugh. And that guy is really good. Corey Michael Smith plays Georgie, and he is really good in this
movie.
When
he's, like, smoking the cigarette and he's, like,
yes,
music supervisor, I could do this job. I was like, yeah. That was probably like the biggest moment of levity in the entire like yeah. second half of the movie.
Jed, have you ever wanted to be a music supervisor?
I would love to be a music supervisor. I actually do think that I would have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. You just pick cool songs.
Yeah. I mean, I dream about it all the time. Like, I was like, I always am like, I'm like, you know what? How cool would it be to like score a movie with entirely like Britpop, you know, just like transport yourself, like set a movie in like the 90s in, you know, in London or Manchester and like score it with basically only Oasis, Supergrass, you know, Blur. Like, I just like, that's the kind of shit that I'm like, I almost do it the opposite way where I'm like, listen to music and I'm like, oh, you know what kind of movie would be fucking sick? I think music supervisors, you know, they can do God's work. Sometimes they're lazy pieces of shit. I'm just making a joke. There's a whole sync world of like how like music gets put in, and a lot of it is like agencies, you know, like agencies right. putting forth music. I was just making a joke. Music supervisors, you guys are all yeah. great. I love you so much.
It's like,
put my music in your
you guys,
stuff.
You guys watch Love is Blind, right?
Yeah.
Like there are songs that are made to be put on that show.
Yes, exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
And there are music supervisors who are probably in cahoots with those bands and those record yeah. labels.
No, the sync world is basically as simple as this, right? Like there are so many artists that only make music to like for sync, which sync is just like music and music for movies and TV. Like, and there are sync agencies, just like there are record labels that shop that stuff around, that have relationship with supervisors and are just like, here's five songs within your budget. Pick one, right? Yeah. Like, here's five songs that like fit the vibe of this project that are within your budget, and that's how most of that stuff gets done, right? Like the stuff we dream about, you know, like Scorsese being like, I need Give Me Shelter, you know, it's like that is the rarity. Like that's like the that doesn't happen.
And AI is just going to make all this worse because ChatGPT is going to spit out these songs from now on.
But oh god, ChatGPT.
Speaking of music, though, it's not.
Oh yeah,
it's not. Like, it's music, and I think it's like maybe a repurposed score from an older movie to a little bit or something. I should have looked.
It feels
into before,
like that. I don't know if it is, but.
Score for the film is an adaptation. Oh yeah, here we go. Michael Legrand's music for The Go-Between. It's a reorchestration, but. Like the loud, like melodramatic music. I mean, I think maybe one of my favorite scenes in the movie, just to throw out one more, is when she does go to the pet shop, and by she I mean Natalie Portman as Elizabeth, goes to the pet shop and ends up in the back and is having somewhat of like a sexual experience in order to get herself into the character of Gracie, who also had sex in that stock room.
She's laying there as if she is, yeah, as if she is like performing
and
a sexual
and
act.
Possibly we only see one of her hands, so like there's stuff going on, and
you were tracking
the music
that,
is just I was tracking that. Well, I was just trying. I'm just trying to account for all limbs at all times when I'm watching a movie. You know, I have a real problem when characters are only shown from the waist up because I'm just like, where are their legs? You know, I need to account for both legs.
Where'd they go?
But in that scene, there is the music is blaring, and there is a really long like zoom in on her from down the hallway, which again, like we should maybe talk a little bit about our guy Chris Blofeld from Kelly Riker fame, who shot this movie beautifully. But it's like this intensely, insanely weird moment, and I feel like it just, the movie like took off for me after that scene because I just felt like I never knew what was going to come next. I feel like I sort of maybe had a grasp on the movie and just completely lost it at that moment, which is so exciting. And I think it's, you know, me specifically, obviously, like, you know, I like Yorgos Lanthimos. We talk about Ari Aster. We talk about the people who maybe are a little bit more my corner than either you guys. And I think part of the similarities there are like going for shock. And I don't, you know, I do like to be shocked in a movie, whether it's like intensely sexual or violent or what have you. And that moment, I feel like I was like, oh my, like, where is this movie going? And a huge part of that was the music, like driving that moment.
Yeah. Good call. let's grade this thing. Get out of here. We've had a really nice conversation about May, December. I want to talk about what you guys thought about it. Give it a grade. It's getting a lot of awards buzz. I want to know if it hit that note for you without spoiling your top five of the year list, which is coming soon. Chip, kick us off. Grade it for me.
Let's do a solid A. Something I noticed, and I think it only happens twice, but it might happen more than that, is there's this recurring motif of a tour happening in the area. I think at least twice, if not maybe three times, you see a tour guide leading a tour in the background of a shot and audibly talking about some attraction in the area. I think that just really speaks to kind of the weird, like, voyeuristic elements of this movie that are also a bit meta about movie making, are a bit meta about true crime and our fascination with tabloid scandals and our willingness to just indulge in them as spectators and come back to them over and over again, while not discerning the true realities of the systematic failings that have happened. We're happy to just see what happened and happy to leave it at that and not come back to it. And I just think that was something that was pretty spectacular and just spoke to the power of this movie. It's hovering, buzzing around, you know, buzzing the tower in the top five.
Evan?
It's nearly an A plus. I'd go like an A at 95.5. It's a strong A. I think it was like exceptionally acted, exceptionally well written, and just like superbly directed. I definitely think, you know, I'm not a great judge of these kinds of things, and maybe it's because it's the most obvious directing, similar to something like The Killer, which is so obviously like put together, but it just felt like easily one of the best directed movies of the year, with all those little choices that added, you know, made it what it was, because it could have been way more straightforward, it could have been even way more ambiguous, it could have been more disgusting, you know, like there are a lot of things that this movie could have been, and I think it struck like the perfect chord. And again, looked great. I really, really wish I could have seen this movie in a theater, because even on Netflix, I thought it looked really good. I love those warm oranges and stuff from that Savannah sunlight. But obviously you still get that like darkness kind of bleeding in on the edges of the screen, watching something shot on film on Netflix. So, but solid A.
Yeah, I'm so torn. I'm really struggling. Have you ever watched a movie and you know it's good and you're really like struggling to parse how much you care about it? And like, there's a lot that I love about it. And so I think I'm going to go solid A, and kind of like with the caveat that I think if I watched again, it might be one of my favorite movies of the year. Like, it's just like, I'm like really like parsing through my emotions with it. And I wish I was able to watch it twice before we podcasted about it.
Well, I don't want to read too much into it, but it sounds like you almost don't want to watch it again, because I think that you not that like Evan and I weren't repulsed by this, but it feels like you maybe, and it's not a bad thing, but it feels like you are just like really struggling to like view this movie as entertainment in a way. Maybe I'm reading into it too much.
No, I don't think it's like you're that far off the mark. I think it's just like reflecting on like my own sensibilities as a young person, and like whatever, like I'll say I was a horny little preteen and teenager, you know, it's like I had a lot of sexual thoughts and like sexual feelings, and I think like there's something so just like almost like it's like weird, like almost like weird, like survivor's guilt, where it's like if presented with that opportunity, like I would have, as a 13-year-old, I would have no question acted on it. And it would have been like, of course, it's like the horror of what you live through. And obviously I'm not alone. Like there are a lot of like young, you know, boys and girls that like fall victim to like predators of that type. And I think it was just like the most like serialized, like watching that happen and then watching it go on as if it was just like a normal, like loving relationship was like really, really jarring for me personally.
And like knowing that they've been living this life for
And then like that's why like I think like watching him like the smoking weed on the roof thing and then the subsequent, you know, their confrontation in the bedroom and kind of like it ending with him really like not getting any closure and her just being like, just come sit next to me, you know, like just like come on, like why are you doing this? And then like leaving the conversation because she doesn't want to confront those emotions.
Straight up gaslight gay.
Oh, I mean, man.
Crying outside the fence, right? Like the final shot of him basically is like, again, the whole movie, like he's watching his kids graduate high school from outside the fence while he breaks down in tears. Like, ew.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's like, obviously like I'm lucky that I didn't experience that, like any trauma like that, but I was able to, I saw a lot of myself, almost like a, what could have been situation, you know, just like reflecting on like who I was as a teenager. And like it was like almost like scary, you know. It's weird. It was much. This was a horror film as much as any film is a horror film for me.
I think that's why she's the ultimate evil, right? Because like you are not alone in that. There are a lot of 13-year-olds who are like, you know, like becoming sexually awakened and like understanding attraction, and it's like up to the adults around you to not indulge that because you are a child.
That's so fucked up. Like that is so, it's so crazy to think about that, like how easy it really is, like for people that are like that to take advantage of those situations because of how like fragile really like you are at that time of life.
Especially in our online age where people, it's not like you had to work at the pet shop, right? It's like everyone, like the teacher's got a smartphone, the kids have a smartphone, and it's like, and it's tough too, because there's also like the element where a lot of the far right is convinced that every teacher ever is grooming every child ever with their agendas. And like, that's really tough and not what this movie is about at all. But it's is a much more nuanced conversation. But like, the movie's called May December because that's a trope, because it really happens. And because it's also like a trope in fiction. And like, I don't know, we were raised on like hot for teacher porn, right? Stepmom porn. Like that like those influences infiltrated all the way down. And I think this movie is, I don't think this movie is about the porn industry or anything like that. But there's something out there the movie's trying to
get after. And I don't discount, and I don't know if you guys had the same reaction, this is the last thing I'll say, but I think part of the reason I felt this way is also, do you notice the year they graduate high school? His kids graduate high school? This is set in 2015. If I'm not mistaken, you guys are the class of 2015, right? Like, I was the class of 2014. Yeah. 2014, but it's kind of just like looking around and almost being like, oh, shit. Like, I don't know. Like, sometimes when they do things like that and it's like set in a year that you can resonate with, it's just like, oh, that's weird. Like, it felt familiar, but
I don't think I realized that, but that is weird.
I thought it was a spectacular film. I think I just need to like parse through it again, like really appreciate a lot of it and kind of like see exactly where I feel on it personally. It's definitely what I will say. It's made me think a lot. It's definitely my top five movies that have made me like contemplate my own life and emotion a lot, which is always a good sign.
I would love to hear the other four.
That's good. Asteroid City's in there for sure.
I still don't understand the play.
I don't understand the play either, Chip. And that's why we keep podcasting, so that one day we might understand the play. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't already, follow us on Twitter at Flick and Scream, on Instagram at Flicking and Screaming. Join the conversation at flickingandscreaming.com. We haven't been doing this always just to give ourselves the flexibility to kind of change on a dime, but I want to warn you that you need to prep for next week's pod. As an end of the year special, we're going to be doing a versus of the original Bourne trilogy. Can't believe it's taken us this long to talk about the Bourne movies. That's kind of like, Evan, I think that's foundational to like some of the first movies that we ever talked about. So I'm so excited. God, I'm just excited to spend some time with Matt Damon, my favorite, my guy. I might rewatch Ford v Ferrari as well in this, just for an excuse to prep for Ferrari as well. But any parting thoughts on May December? Is it your guys' best picture winner? Should it be nominated for best picture? Let's put it that way.
Yes.
Yes.
I agree. Flicking and Screaming.
Jets. I wouldn't be upset if it won. I'll put it that way.
Yes. Wow. Started right now. Should we be the May December pod? Should we plant our flag yet? Let's see the rest of the movies.
I don't know how insane that would be if this movie went, like, there would be so many people who are just like,
the discourse, the fucking discourse. I can't.
All the guys on Twitter and Reddit, like all the Nolan heads would just like melt.
That's true.
Pharrelly Gain Screaming, Jed Sprague, Evan Vaganis, JT Chipman. Have a good one, everybody.
See ya.
See ya.
And now, the starting lineup for your
Gangsters. What's up, guys?
Are you a slacker?
Envy.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
God bless the internet.